Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 106. My name is Charles Lowell, a developer here at Frontside, and I'm going to be hosting today's episode. And we're going to be talking about microstates with fellow Frontside developers, David Keithley and Taras Mankowski. So welcome, y'all.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
I'm really, really excited that we finally get to talk about this, but before we jump into this, just wanted to let everybody know that last week we published our roadmap for Big Test, which is a JavaScript acceptance testing framework that we've been building right in here in-house at Frontside, which can work with both Ember applications and React applications, Vue applications, and everybody, it's in the alpha phase and we're looking for feedback, but we're really excited about it. So we're going to leave a link to that in the show notes and please go check it out. All right. So finally, the moment has come that we actually get to talk about this publicly. I mean, we've been publishing things about microstates for a while now, but we feel that it's ready to share with the world. And that's really, really exciting. So we should probably like wind the clock back a few years, because that's about how long we've been working on this, and talk about kind of the why and the what of what microstates are. It's kind of a weird word. So what are we doing here?
Yeah, so that's it's an interesting question, because, you know, we've been working on it for so long, and it's, you know, after all this time, it's like, you know, what is this specifically that we're working on? I can speak personally from my personal motivations. You know, because we had conversations over the last 2 years, like, you know, why are we doing this? And I think for me personally, it's always been that I've been mentoring building complex applications for almost 5 years now. And one of the things that I find consistently is that there are patterns for how to build complex stateful UIs that require solutions that are fairly, like, reliably consistent. Like, you could actually, if we're using certain patterns, like, I can teach people certain patterns and then they can use these patterns to build complex applications, and those patterns scale really well. The challenge is that these patterns are not really, there's not an easy way to express them, and it's different for every framework. So the way that I would teach somebody how to do it, for example, in Ember versus how they would do it in React, even though the pattern itself is the same, but the implementation of that pattern is different, but it's different in such a way that it's very difficult to see where the consistency is, like, what is the same about these two patterns. And it shows me that there is room for improvement, you know, in the same way that if there is an opportunity that in the future components will get unified under, like, one umbrella, like, web component spec, you know, the fact that we do state so differently across every implementation, across every opinion, it suggests that what we might be missing is something that would unify across frameworks how we actually do state management.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, because as much as people try to buck the trend of MVC, like, it keeps, like, coming back in the rear view. Hopefully not like a, you know, a horror villain, but like, you know, a caring friend, like, you know, a reliable pattern. I remember when I was writing, like, Java applications, even, like, back in the day, the most important thing when you were writing a swing application was making sure that you had your models right. And if you were modeling, you know, either a form or a dialogue or, you know, a set of pages, the most important thing was to have those models. And yes, like, back in the day, we modeled those things with, you know, event listeners, very similar to where the way, like, a Backbone application used to work, or if you're familiar with Ember Object, the way that it worked, you know, basically adding observers to some model so that when that model changed, you were able to react to that. Your representation was able to be 100% dependent on this model. And that was like a Java swing application, which was then inherited from this pattern from Smalltalk. And so, but we keep on seeing this again and again and again, right? There is this piece, this state, that if you're going to be representing something, then you need to be able to get at the meat of it. And that's ultimately what the model is in the MVC pattern. I mean, I remember when React first came out, everybody was, you know, oh, MVC is dead. But now, in terms of state management and all of the state management solutions that we see, it's like what that really is the model trying to reassert itself. as you know, it's just because it's such an important piece of your application, it's going to rear its head and you cannot escape it. And so, I mean, I make it sound like a problem. I guess it is a problem, but like there's a proliferation of solutions out there that are attacking the problem of, in order to represent something, you have to know what that something is.
I think when you've only worked with one framework, your perspective might be very much shaded by your experience. So like if you're really good at building React applications and you subscribe to like, you know, Pojo is king and you don't need anything beyond that, then you're going to get good at handling Pojos and you might not realize that there's actually limitations to what you're doing. And I think the same applies to people who use Ember and they're using Ember Object and they have computer properties. And now in Angular, there's observables and, you know, subscribing to streams. What's been really interesting with the work that we've been doing with microstates is that, like, one of the things that I've noticed with other state management solutions is that a lot of them emerge as, oh, I had this insight. I spent a couple of days working on it. Here's my proposal, in a way, for managing state. And I think that's great because I think insight and understanding is really important, but sometimes taking the time to design something can be really helpful. And I think that's one of the things that's been really interesting with microstates is that because we've taken so long to, like, we've been iterating on it for so long, we've been testing it for so long, I think we've been able to do something in microstates that's really difficult to do when you have a production application that you're, you know, you're like, oh, I want something different. Something is not enough, but I don't have the time to really make it better. Or you're, you know, I have an idea, I want to release this thing, but I don't have any other collaborators that I can talk to and like really flesh out these ideas. And so what you get is you get a solution, but it doesn't always touch on a lot of the angles that mm-hmm. you kind of want to touch on. And so there are specific things like, you know, it's really interesting to think about.
I say we should talk about those angles. Like, what are some of those angles?
Yeah, so I mean, you could think about this from a few different perspectives. Like, I'll start from Ember perspective because that's been kind of my personal starting point. And so when you work with Ember, one of the things you use a lot, and so this is actually, you know, for anyone who's listening, Ember and Vue, for all intents and purposes in this scenario, are very similar because they have the same primitive, which is the computer property. The computer property in Ember and the computer property in Vue is almost identical from the way that you actually consume it. And so in Ember, you would use computer properties, and in Vue, you'd use computer properties to create derived state from data that's passed into the component. And then you would use this derived state to basically decorate information that comes through props so you could present it in your component. And this pattern is very nice. Like, this pattern is being used to build LinkedIn, to build applications at Apple. Like, these are big, huge applications being built by Ember community using these patterns. And I'm sure something similar is happening now with Vue. But this pattern doesn't really exist in React in the same way. You might kind of opt in to start using this pattern if you start using Reselect. But it's not quite the same as like you writing computer properties in Ember is essentially, and in Vue is essentially free because you just, it's so effortless. Where in React, if you're using Reselect to create cached computer properties or memoized computer properties, you are really opting into doing a particular way of computing those properties, like writing selectors. It's not trivial. So I think that's like a one thing that is available in Vue and Ember, and it's a really effective pattern, and you can do it in React, but it's actually not possible in Angular unless you're using, I'm guessing, something like ngRx, where you can do similar things to what you would do with Redux in React. So creating derived state that you can consume in mm-hmm. your component is like one of the things that is possible, but it's not possible consistently across all frameworks.
Right.
And that's just one of the things.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that was one of the things that was, you know, drew me to Ember at first, coming from Backbone as I did. And honestly, from the models in Java, was that in order to compute anything, you had to install a listener and then eagerly make that computation and then store it somewhere. Whereas, you know, those frameworks made it feel effortless, where you can just decorate some state and derive it. And it's just the information is there, the computation is there when you need to reach for it, but you don't have to expend any extra effort aside from, say, like, you know, this state is derived off this other state. I think another case that I kind of came across was immutability. Immutability is a means, but the end is to have consistency inside your application. And so I first really started running up against this when I was working with forms. And, you know, since then, I've realized that I was actually, a lot of the pain that I was feeling was because I was, things were not being immutable. But this is where the fact that things weren't immutable ended up causing me a lot of pain and headaches, and I was having to, the code ended up being like a lot more complex. So essentially, when I wanted to make something transactional, if you're editing in a form, something like that, then you need to essentially store off a copy of your current state. And then you need to be able to, you know, like if you're editing some object, I want to say, open up a dialogue and I'm going to edit it. And then I'm going to commit the changes back to that dialogue. Well, really what I'm modeling there is a transaction. So I kind of need to shave off a copy or, you know, make a Xerox copy of the object and then make the changes inside to that object. And then somehow try and like merge those changes upstream and then get them back into kind of the mainline. It's really like a very Git-like operation. And it wasn't just, you know, at the object level, when you're doing things like dirty checking, you need to make what is the original value of a field versus what does the input currently have. And I might be doing any number of transformations in between, you know, the actual physical representation of the field. Maybe it's a date, but, you know, the user interacts with it as a string. So there has to be this kind of parse and serialize things sitting in between that value. And you need to basically keep a copy of that field as a mini transaction within your macro transaction, because you want to say, like, is it dirty? Well, is it really the same object? Because if you can't just do an object comparison, then you have to get into all this hairy, like, equality checking. And it gets really complex really fast. And it turns out that a very clean solution to this is if you just never actually make the changes in place. And you always, whenever you are making changes, you're generating new information without destroying the old information. Because when you're, a form is the case where we really come up against this, where we're kind of modeling the same object over time. So a form explicitly models the change of an object. Change is part of what it is. And so the definition of change is being able to compare something in its prior state to be able to compare it to its current state. So if you're making the change by destroying the prior state, then you're going to run into a lot of trouble. So it just turns out that when you are, you know, when you're working with forms, and it turns out there are a lot of use cases like this, but this was the one that was where I first really just couldn't even without immutability, you want to model your change as always rolling forward and not ever destroying prior states, but being able to pick and choose and always be able to look back to where you were and compare where you are now to where you were. So you know, that's where immutability comes, right? When you're modeling change, it's actually much easier to model change when you have explicit states that represent what was and what is. But when you start doing that, then things get a little bit messy, right? There's a compromise, there's a trade-off, right? Like when I say, you know, set this property on this object, that is easy. And that's something that I think that we can all understand, right? And that's why, you know, we're not idiots. That's why immutable models are, you know, they're very conceptually easy to grasp, to wrap your head around. You know, if I'm modeling myself and I'm saying I'm raising my hand, well, I say like set hand position, you know, 2 feet up in the air. And, you know, now I'm raising my hand. That's easy to understand. And it turns out that when you're making, you know, when you're changing a data structure immutably, then you have to, for example, you know, model, you know, a simple set operation as like a duplicate and swap. Or if you're, say, like you're swapping out one property in an array, you actually model that as a map instead of just setting the, you know, you model that as a map where you swap out the one element at that index. Rather than just saying, just set the thing at that index. right? Essentially, you're doing an, you know, or if I'm changing a property, an object, I want to copy over all the fields except for that one, which I'm going to change, right? And if you start to do that, then, you know, you get, you realize the benefit of always being able to look backwards, right? But you've now introduced overhead and complexity into your code. And so you've made a trade-off. And that's, you know, I think that a lot of people look at saying, you know, I want this to be immutable. Then they actually have to kind of come to the grips with the complexity that's going to introduce. And there are libraries like Immutable.js that do make that a lot better. But even they have the problems. And so I can talk about those, but maybe we should like, that's one of the cases is like being able to reason about a series of states for your object rather than just only having one copy of it ever and being stuck with having to deal with it as it is.
Yeah. And I think that's really important too, is being able to sort of mentally track where you've been. Because in my experience on other large Ember applications, I've run into so many different bugs that I could really track down to people, or rather places in the code where things are just reaching in and mutating your model where it just wouldn't make sense. So as you're writing your code, you know, you're in a completely different state than you might have expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, and that even like it's easy, right? But it's essentially when you have some model, you basically got a global object. There's a lot of recomputation that needs to happen when those things change. And so as a result, if you look at the actual code that supports computed properties in Ember, and I'm sure other frameworks as well, it's like some of the most hairy, like complex, you know, it's actually, I mean, if you look at the chain watchers and the chain nodes and all the stuff that's required to support things like computer properties, it's actually, I mean, it's amazing that it works as well as it does. I've tried to actually open that up and understand that code on a number of occasions, and every single time had to walk away in defeat.
this problem exists in React applications and in Angular applications, because if you think of the challenges of working with set state, I think one of the problems with working with set state in React is that your complexity increases very quickly. It starts off kind of simple from when you're using mutability with set state in React. It starts off kind of very light, and then as you start to add features, your complexity starts to grow very quickly in a way that, you know, where you really start to kind of run into limitations. You start to confront your personal limitations of your abilities to work with immutability. So you end up having to do things like, you for example, you're limited to doing immutable structures that are only a few levels deep, because your ability to use destructuring to create new immutable objects is limited by expressiveness of JavaScript. And it's gotten a lot better with destructuring, but you know, if you do a few levels deep, I think everybody's familiar with what happens. It starts to get really hairy, like kind of lose track of where you are.
Yeah, the signal to noise ratio increases because, you know, after probably two or three levels, you know, the majority of your code has to do with destructuring and restructuring and very little with the actual change that you wanted to make.
And this is kind of interesting because people talk about declarativeness versus imperativeness, but at certain point, when you have a complex immutable state change, you know, if you're doing it with destructuring, your code, even though it looks declarative, but there is so much processing that you're doing that it's actually kind of losing the benefit of its declarativeness. Like it actually starts to look more like imperative code than it does what you would expect a declarative system to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this kind of touches on the other aspect. You know, it's kind of compromise that you make when you work mutably. One of the compromises you make is your serialization, right? Your ability to represent your state as a POJO becomes restricted by the fact that you have this complex system that's wired together, and you have systems like zones in Angular that is able to, and in Ember, you know, Ember object that are able to keep track of changes in these objects, but you don't have a way to restore those objects. You don't have a way to do more sophisticated things that you might want to do, like especially in situations where you have dynamically, like if a server is feeding you what the UI is going to look like, in that situation, it's really helpful to be able to say, here's a Pojo that I got from the server. I'm going to use this Pojo to build the component tree that the user is going to interact with. And then as the user interacts with it, I'm going to then capture that state, serialize it, and put it back in the server. When you're using something like if you're using Ember Object, or if you're doing this kind of stuff in Angular, or even if you're doing this kind of stuff with React but without using something like Redux, you essentially end up doing so much wiring to accomplish that that you, by the time that you're finished writing your application, you've written a ton of code just to handle this particular use case. And if you have to do this again in another application, you've just rewritten that ton of code in the new application as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of like the concept of a Smalltalk image. Like there's no way to really get at the state of a Smalltalk thing. You just have to copy the whole, like it's almost like you're dealing in Docker containers and not actually being able to write that state down into like JSON or something like that. I'm trying to think of it. I'm casting about for an appropriate analogy. Maybe that's not a good one, but yeah, it's kind of like the state only exists in that one, like what's actually happening cannot be made orthogonal. It can only exist in that one runtime that you're currently running. So if like something wrong manifests itself, reproducing it can be extraordinarily difficult, right? Like Imagine if you're trying, there's some render cycle that's, making a bunch of mutations, and there's kind of this process that you've stood up, and it runs in completion, some signal comes in and that those effects like ripple through the system. There's no way at any point to have any other representation of that system than the system itself, than the running system itself.
There's another element to this, which I find is really interesting, which is when you're thinking about how to architect complex UIs, it's actually helpful to get really clear about what state changes are happening. A lot of times when I see beginners are writing, especially if you task someone who is fairly junior at building single page applications, what a lot of times will happen is because they don't have a clear mental model of what is going on in regards to state, they end up setting a lot of properties. Like every operation ends up being like every time you kind of have an event handler, because they don't have a clear model of what's going on, they end up setting like 5 or 6 or 7 properties. And that kind of signals to me that that they don't have a clear picture. But what that also does is that a lot of times that usually comes together with cascading property state changes. Like usually they're not representing a single operation as a single state change, because there mm-hmm. might actually be a bunch of things that are happening because what they're doing is they're kind of massaging the system into submission, not like. They're not in control of the state transition, so they use essentially time and their dedication to kind of sort it out and make it work. And it eventually what that ends up looking like is that it works for most of the cases that they are able to test for or that they're able to like manually see, but then they are not accounting for problems that they're not able to understand right now. They just mm-hmm. simply they become discovered by users when users start to interact with the system and with the components or with the application, and the application starts to get into some funky states. And there's nothing, like the tools that we have, they don't prevent that from happening.
They don't force you. I think what you're saying is that ideally you want to model your UI as a set of transactions on your state, right? You want a transactionality to your state. So that I basically am saying I'm not going around and setting 7 properties in reaction to this one event. I'm saying this event triggers this transaction, and that transaction clearly bundles up every single operation that needs to happen, and the tools don't enforce that. Is that a fair?
Yeah. And the problem is we're working with component trees. So as your features, like you start off with having a set of requirements, and over time the requirements change as you know, as the business unit understands your application better, they, you know, they give you more direction of like how things should work. And then you find out that there's more interconnected state. But then what's happening now is that the cost of refactoring that those state, that state that spread throughout the components, whether that be with set state, whether that be with, you know, with actions or getters, with actions in Ember or even in Angular, what you end up doing is you start to change the system, but but change is not trivial because the mm-hmm. actual process of changing where that state lives is not linear. It depends on the complexity of the code that you wrote, and it just gets really hairy very quickly. And that's where companies end up losing a lot of time. You know, a developer could start off with, you have a requirement, you build something, and then a new requirement comes in, and instead of it being a simple change, it turns into a week or 2 weeks refactor because you now understand that state ownership should be different. So the state that you have should be in a different place. You have to manually make that change. You have no abstraction to help you express that in an easy way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another thing, because I think we need we are, you know, doing a kind of a roundup of, you know, all the things that you need to account for when you actually embark on like managing your state. Another is actually constraining the amount of computation that happens. So if your system is based on listeners and large chains of, you know, large chain reactions of things where, you know, this property changes, so I need to notify these other 10 dependent properties that change, you know, notify these other 10 dependent properties that change, you can do a lot of unnecessary computation, especially if nobody's going to render it. And that's kind of the thing that you have to do if you're going to be mutable, is you have to eagerly walk those chains to see which objects are affected so that you can then invalidate those caches. You know, a system like Ember Object, I don't know exactly how Vue works, mitigates this somewhat by the fact that the computed properties are lazy, but you still have to walk all of those chains. That can get out of hand. So, you know, they're eager, not lazy. And then the other concern that you have where you'd normally have to make a trade-off around is around composability. Right. So one of the things that's really nice about mutable systems is they're very composable. Right. So I can just set, if I've got some object that does one thing, I can then just set that object onto another object just by mutating one of its properties, and I've effectively composed them. And, you know, I can then install listeners onto that thing, or I can, you know, compute properties off of that property, and they compose pretty well. That's something that you get. But then, of course, you're losing all the benefits of immutability. And so, you know, that's why things like, you know, immutable JS don't really compose very well, or Redux doesn't really compose very well. The concept of taking a Redux store and, you know, embedding it into another Redux store, you just don't see that, right? I would never distribute. And I think ultimately the litmus test there is, would I be able to share it on something like NPM? Nobody shares a NPM package that's just a Redux store that you can dispatch actions to and observe and use it with your other Redux stores. When it comes to a system like immutable JS, that does make, you know, transitions a little bit easier over like lists and arrays and maps, but, you know, it's things you still run into the exact same set of problems that you have when you have lists of maps of records, and you don't really get any help there. So it's like you have to make this trade-off between immutability and composability, you know, whereas a system like MobX or Ember Object actually is quite composable. So before we start talking about microstates, I wanted to say that, you know, just throw those in there because there is just a lot of concerns out there, a lot of edge cases that actually build up. But through the course of a real application, you will encounter them all. And so you might be making trade-offs at the beginning that you're not realizing that you're going to need or going to get you into trouble later on.
Yeah, this actually happens in the Angular community as well, because there's something really great that's happening with observables in the Angular community. I think everyone's embracing them wholeheartedly, and I think that's been pretty great to see. But observable streams are composable. But objects that have on them observable stream providers of some kind, like if you have something that you can subscribe to, and that is part of a property on a class, composing multiple classes together and consuming properties from those classes, there is no mechanism for composing that. That kind of composition has to be done manually. And you're essentially, by the time, like, again, you're kind of manually wiring together a bunch of objects. And the big challenge is that you are manually subscribing to all those streams. And you don't, and unlike what you have with components, is that we components have lifecycle hooks. When your component's being torn down, you know you can perform some operations. If you need to, like, remove an event listener, you have a hook where you can do that. When you have class instances, like regular JavaScript class instances that have on them properties that have observables that you subscribe to, there are no teardown hooks for class instances. So you don't really, there are no abstractions for managing unsubscribing from those streams. So you essentially end up having the foundation that you can use to build complex reactive systems, and you can, it can use to subscribe, and they're really fast, but wiring those things together at a bigger scale is simply not there. I mean, it's something that you have to, you have to create and enforce yourself.
Right. And I think that's probably kind of a perfect segue into talking about microstates, which is, you know, the project that we've been alluding to for the past 30 minutes that is, I think, an attempt to solve these problems and make sure that you don't actually have to compromise on those things. So you can reason about things locally, but have those things be composed into a greater state, but also have them be immutable so that you can look at past states and reason over a data structure over time, as opposed to just in one instance. And also have an intuitive interface that, you know, when you're making these changes, doesn't look like it's your, you know, half of your code is unpacking some data structure, flipping some bit in it, and then repackaging it back up again. So that, I mean, that's like the context. So should we start talking about what microstates is and how it addresses those?
That's a good next step. I mean, there's a lot of, when I started working on the README, my original plan, you know, I end up actually, I think I wrote about 40 pages. It wasn't because, like, one thing that's kind of interesting about microstates is that, and this was part of the design of microstates from the work that we've done, is that we intentionally wanted to make the number of ideas that you have in microstates very little. So when you use microstates, the number of concepts that you need to remember in your mind is very few. It is a conceptually a different way of thinking about organizing your state, in the same way that, like, shifting from managing DOM elements directly to having an abstraction like component that declaratively applies changes to your DOM tree. In the same way, microstates is kind of an abstraction that allows you to declaratively describe how your state will change, and it will manage the state transitions for you, and it allows you to give those state transitions names, and it allows you to give your states names as well, right? So you can actually name things. You don't get a POJO that is, you know, it has a shape but has no name. You actually get to give things names.
Right. So why don't we start? So I have a list in my mind. I should probably write it down, of the things that we just talked about. But, you know, I think the things that we talked about are ease of representation, like conceptually easy, transactional, you know, basically serializable and immutable, lazy and composable. Those are like five or six things. So maybe, but I think that our kind of aligning principle around which we gather is that the state management should feel easy. It should feel fun. You know, one of the things that is awesome about working with components, whether you're using web components or React components or Ember components, is you're just when you get it right, you're just snapping these things to feel together, and it feels great. It's like I'm just passing properties and render blocks down the tree, and the framework is just, you know, it's doing all of the grunt work for me, and I'm just operating at a very high level. And that's our organizing principle with microstates, is it needs to feel easy. So, I mean, maybe we should start there and just say, how does that easy and fun line up with each one of those kind of unique problems around which we typically have to make trade-offs? So we could start with, you know, the interface of like making a change.
So there's actually, I'll go back to kind of the starting point. I remember what got me first kind of interested in microstates is when Charles, when you said that when you have a number, like there are certain operations that a number can do. We really don't need to be writing an increment operation for every, like if you have a number, that, you can increment it and decrement it. Right?
That, well, that honestly, every time I see a state management tutorial and like they tell you how to increment and decrement a number with it, and like they, you write the increment code and you track the thing and like you store it back into the store, I just, at this point, I'm so annoyed with those tutorials because like it's a number. We know we can increment it. Like, just show me where to plug in the code. Yeah, like, don't, I don't, like, you know, like, I should not have to be writing an increment method.
Yes, and so I think, so. The, and that's the kind of the starting point, right? So there are certain operations that you can perform with the primitive types. So, like, if you need to add a number, or if you need to increment a number, the number, we already know how to increment a number. It's part of microstates. But that in itself is, I mean, it's nice, but that's not that important. What I think was really important is that when you need to put a number into another data structure, like, so let's say you have like have an app and you're like, okay, I need to, I don't know, you know,
like you
could
have a click, let's say like a click tracker that has a number of clicks.
Right. By itself, you can increment the click tracker. But if you need to put that click tracker into another app, you essentially, you can compose it in, and the actual, like, you don't need to figure out how to wire the actual mechanism of, like, how to make sure that you can update the property. Like, when it's part of another class, for example, you don't need to, the way you would increment that number when it's part of another class versus how you would do it when you're working with it by itself is approximately the same. The amount of work that you need to do to actually perform that operation is the same. There's no, your complexity doesn't increase, you know, as you compose one data structure into another.
Right. You can just say, this is an app, it's got a click tracker, and this property is a click tracker, and I have to do nothing else. You know, I can register clicks on that thing. It doesn't increase the complexity of the application at all.
There's no wiring, right? Like all the wiring, right, of making sure that, like, now that you added some new state, that state is very explicit, and there are no, like, it's really clear that this is not impacting other parts of the state. You can operate with this thing. If you change it, it's going to work properly with all the other things that are in the type that you're adding this counter to. Like, those things are just going to fit well together, and you don't need to, like, it's not going to break if you need to transition one more thing. Like, all of your other transitions will work the same way. Like, I think that kind of consistency is really meaningful when you, over time, especially when you start to increase the amount of state that you manage in your application.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the ability to work with types and just have kind of those implicit operations and have those things compose kind of indefinitely. Moving down, we talked about easy. And the other thing I would put on that is that the way in which you express those transitions, for example, microstates comes bundled with numbers and Booleans and strings and arrays and objects and, you know, kind of the stable of types that you would expect in any JavaScript application. But those types are expressed using this way for expressing types, essentially. And when you actually do make a transition, it feels very object-oriented, I would say, even though it's not. It feels like you're mutating, but you're actually doing a transition. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think for anyone who's familiar with what it's like to write queries for GraphQL, if you're not familiar with it, it's fine. You can get a sense of that from microstates. But if you're familiar with the ease of, like, just writing a query, and if your backend knows how to retrieve the data, then your queries will just give you the data that you want. Like, that feeling is really powerful of just being able to, like, write the query and it just gives you what you want. Microstates is kind of like that. We actually, like, the inspiration came from, you know, from experience with GraphQL, which is that sense of ease is kind of what we wanted to have in microstates. And so you get that same sense of, like, oh, I can just add what I want, and it's just going to work, and I'm going to add this other thing, and it's just going to work, and it's like, and you just kind of breathe, like, flying through your, like, adding states to your application, and it's just, like, working for you and working for you and working for you, and you don't have to do monkey work of, like, you know, gluing things together, changing how things are working before, you know, because you have a way of working with these things at a higher level.
Right. So let's talk about, like, transactionality. or should we talk about immutability? You know, how does this make immutability easy and fun?
I think one thing is that you don't have to write reducers and you don't have to do destructuring by hand. So I think you could actually, you have a way of expressing. So one of the ways of thinking about this could be that if you have a component tree, and that component tree, so let's say like if you have Redux and you have a component tree and then a bunch of components, like your parent component, your root component has some state using set state, and then components further down the tree also have state. So the way you could actually express that as a microstate, so that you, what you would do is you essentially the parent component state would be the root, and then you would the children's component states would be composed into it. The nice things about doing that is that at the root level, like you have access to transition the state of the children declaratively. You know where the states for those children is on the root type, and you can write transitions that are going to declaratively perform multiple operations on the children's state, and it follows similar structure to what happens in components. But you know, if you don't use this, you might have multiple set state operations, or you might need to the process of wiring data from the root down to the children is kind of complicated. Where here you have a way to represent that and perform a lot of transitions in a way that is going to be just easy at whatever level you need to operate at.
Right. I think for people familiar with Redux, you act globally, and you basically, yeah, you act globally and then you react locally, if that makes sense. So you dispatch an action to the entire store, and every single reducer can see that action. And there's ways to manage that, but effectively you have this one atom, and then you have the reducers that kind of act on local state. Whereas with microstates, you're basically acting locally, you're reacting locally, but the effect is global.
You're participating globally.
You're participating globally, and so like, but you never have to consider a context that is above your own. And so that's like, you never have to be mindful or cognizant of a context in which you're enclosed, because from your perspective, it just doesn't exist.
Yeah, and so it's kind of amazing that, so there's one, like every microstate has a set transition, which is kind of the basic transition that that you can invoke on essentially any type. And so what's interesting is that it's amazing how powerful.
So we should break it down, like get it like really simple. Is basically when you create a microstate with a type. So you create a microstate, you say like, I want to create a number with the value 5, right? And then I can just say that returns a microstate, and then I can say, you know, microstate.set 10, and that will return a new microstate who's also a number, but the value is 10.
If you have,
and that's available on all microstates.
Yes. If you have a tree of components and your state is represented by a microstate at the root level, then what you can do is it's very easy to pass, like you can invoke the transitions on any part of the microstate, and it will just know how to properly create the next microstate for you. So this is like the example that Charles, you gave of one number, so that number can be inside of a class that represents state for a particular component, and then that can be part of another class that represents state for another component. But then when you invoke a transition on one of the kind of leaf nodes, you call set state on one of the leaf nodes, it will respond locally, but it will actually reflect the changes globally. At the root level, you're going to get a new object that causes the components to update.
You know what? Another concern that actually just popped into my head, which is something that, you know, I've certainly struggled with in every single application of, you know, notable complexity, is stability of value. We should put that on the list. I mean, we're almost out of time to talk about this. We spent not too much time. We spent talking about all kind of the issues of state management, which I think you can't spend enough time talking about. But I did want to pile one more on there is, you know, when you're making that transition where you're acting locally but you're participating globally. You know, for things that are unaffected by your action remain unchanged. That is a superpower. It's actually very hard to do with a lot of state management, especially when you're cloning a bunch of stuff, being very judicious about what you don't want to clone. So where this really comes into play is if I want to re-render something, a lot of times you have to jump through a bunch of hoops to tell, well, did my model really change or did it only referentially change? So with microstates, when you make that local change, if you're embedded in a very large graph of objects, obviously all of the objects above you are going to be changed. But what about things that are off to the side, your siblings? You know, they're outside the scope of that change. They shouldn't be cloned. They shouldn't be copied over. They should remain the same. And so if you're doing, you're re-rendering based on the changes that are happening, that's going to be a key feature because you're not going to have to write any, basically, any hooks to say, should I have to re-render my component? You can rely on triple equals.
This quality is kind of described as structural sharing and some of the other tools that are available. But I think that's how it's accomplished. I think one thing that's a little bit different with microstates is that when it comes to structural sharing, it's not that difficult to do if you're just doing structural sharing on the value, meaning that you can do structural sharing on the value using something like lenses. And not a lot of people are familiar with lenses in JavaScript, but it's actually like only three functions that you can use, and it can give you structural sharing on complex POJOs. It's pretty easy to use relative to like how little people know about it. But what that doesn't do is it doesn't allow you to like graphs of objects that have their own operations that you can invoke, mm-hmm. And that will perform structural sharing. That part is I know that is not available in any solution. I think is in terms at the level of kind of completeness and luxury that microstate provides,
right?
When you use these things,
yeah, because every piece of the tree kind of comes bundled with its own things that you can do with it.
I think I don't think we necessarily need to jam everything into this podcast because there's a lot to talk about. I think one of the things that is we've talked about this a lot, which is that what we want to do is create an implementation for an idea of what it would look like. What would it be like if we had a composable state primitive that we could use to describe state and share state solutions? You know, in the same way that we share components like, you know, React Virtualized or whatever your particular framework's popular component might be. Like, what would it look like if we had solutions to state problems that we could share and we could leverage.
I mean, I think that's the litmus test of an awesome solution is like you look at this current crop of MVC frameworks, and what's so awesome about them is you can actually, there's sharing that can happen, right? If I'm writing a React component, I can publish it on NPM and other people can use it. If I have an Ember add-on, I can publish it and people can use it. They can consume those components, right? That's awesome. And I think it's the hallmark of a great system. What would it look like if I wrote just the state piece of a file upload and I could publish it to NPM and then anybody in any framework could actually use it with their framework without paying any penalty? What would it look like if there was some, you know, transactional data store that could be built and shared, and you know, the hooks into any framework were minimal? You know, there's the possibilities are really exciting around that idea, whether it is realized as microstates or not. But clearly, we feel that this is something you should be able to do.
I'll add one more kind of use case that I personally find really motivating is that there's a lot of companies that are investing into building single page applications, and a lot of times they are what you see happening is they're building the same very similar application to what they had before, because their business hasn't changed. The technology has moved on, so the solutions have improved. The demands for better user experience have increased, but the actual business and how and the things that people have to do on day to day within their company hasn't changed. And so what we're seeing right now is we're seeing the same, like whatever was written before in jQuery or in AngularJS is now being rewritten in React or Angular or whatever you might choose. But what I really like to see is have a situation where the domain specific logic of your business is represented as a data structure that knows how to potentially in the future talk to the server and retrieve data from the API, because that's likely not going to change. But you can use that, like that's been tested as an NPM and published as an NPM module within your enterprise, and then you can then consume that in any framework, and it's actually easier to do it this way than to implement it in a framework-specific version of their state management. That's the part that I find the most like exciting, and I'm really I think one of the things just to connect to kind of the goal is that we would like to keep this conversation going. So if you're interested, I think this is a kind of a call to our audience, is that if you're interested in this, we would love to have on our podcast to talk about these things, because I think there's a lot of things that, like microstates really is the beginning of a conversation. It's not meant to be a statement. It's meant to be a proposal that we can use to talk about this.
I agree. And that's one of the reasons we're keeping it very small at this point. I mean, the core library of microstates is not setting out to accomplish too much. Like in the core library, there aren't even any side effects. Like it's actually impossible to have side effects. It means that it cannot be used for anything except for the model. But you know, that's very liberating, and it let us focus on what would a system like this actually look like.
And so it's really exciting because we've been this is the biggest vanity metric, but you know we had microstates in the JavaScript Weekly, and that was great, and then it got circled around and people and you know it's like 800 stars now, which is like not really a big deal, but it's funny because you know somebody commented like, how can you put something in production that doesn't you know that only had 100 stars, right?
I think it's just important to realize that this really is the beginning of the conversation. There's like a really like exciting set of things to come. And, you know, we haven't even talked about how we're going to model side effects, although we're going to use microstates to do it. You know, we haven't even talked about what the various framework integrations will look like and what are the best practices for using this to organize state in your application. You know, we've had some lively discussions internally about what that would look like. There's still a lot of questions, but it's going to be a really, really exciting and edifying experience to get to answer them.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I'm excited to have there's been a lot of interest from people in microstates, and so it's going to be really great to, like, I'm looking forward to meeting people and having conversations about how we could use microstates, because I'd love to have someone create a really great solution that I could just take off the shelf and just use and not have to implement it myself.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we could talk about microstates for at least the next 3 hours, but we have to give everybody an opportunity to at least like go to the bathroom or something. So microstates will return, but if you're interested in learning more about microstates and you happen to be in one of the many places on which we're going to be presenting on microstates in the future, who knows, maybe you can come in and join the conversation in person. So Taras is going to be speaking at Toronto.js on July 30th. He's also going to be presenting at Manhattan.js on August 8th. And then yours truly will be presenting on microstates at React.js Austin on the 6th of August. So come out and see us. We'll drop those in the show notes, and it's guaranteed to be a good time. And we'll have that conversation. Until then, we are the front side. We lead with the why, the how, and then the what, if you're interested in working with us. And that helps us that we guarantee the lowest total cost of ownership for your application. We're always looking for feedback. If you have news items that you'd like to see at the head of the show, or just any feedback or questions, would be happy to answer them. Thanks today to Mandy Moore for producing our show. And next time, we'll be talking with Christian Freeman about what it's like to run an online conference with Twitch. So I'll be looking forward to that. Bye, David. Bye, Theras.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yep, and bye, everybody. See you next time.